Support for WPR comes from National Eagle Center, hosting SOAR Fall Flight, with programs from World Bird Sanctuary and Midwest Peregrine Society, September 21st and 22nd. NationalEagleCenter.org.
Well, like many gardeners, you probably like to see birds in your yard. And on Garden Talk today, we'll tell you how to create a great habitat for them. This is the Larry Mueller Show, and I'm Jill Nadeau. Our guest is writer, editor, and photographer Jen McGinnis. Her new book is Bird Friendly Gardening: Guidance and Projects for Supporting Birds in Your Landscape. Do you select plants that will help birds? What other elements have you added to your bird-friendly yard? We'd like to hear about them, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
And you are out on the East Coast, correct?
I am. I'm based in Connecticut.
Okay. Well, birds are similar all around. So any of your advice will definitely come through for Wisconsin birders and people who want to have a bird-friendly yard. You start your book with a term that I was not aware of. You call it a spark bird. Explain what that is.
Sure. So a spark bird is the bird that really caught your eye and then made you actually get started or interested in birding. So for me, when I was a child, I was growing up in the city in New York, and we had a bird feeder that we put out in the wintertime, and we would always get these beautiful red cardinals that would come and visit the feeder. So for me, I would consider the cardinal my spark bird, because that was the first one that like really drew my eye, and you know, I was aware of all the other birds that were present in the city, you know, but that was the one that I was like, oh, I really like that, and I want to learn more about it.
Well, I can understand that. I think that a cardinal probably is a spark bird for a lot of people. It's so brilliant.
Absolutely. And I feel like it's very popular for other reasons, too. Like, you know, people associated with, like, their loved ones who have passed on, or just, like you said, the beauty that they bring to the garden. And the, you know, not to slight the females, because they're really pretty, too.
They are, too. And I think without the male sitting next to them, you'd be like, oh, what a beautiful bird.
Yeah.
And then the male comes by, and it's like, oh, my gosh.
Aren't you flashy?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's pretty typical for the bird world, I guess. But so, you know, I think we're all concerned, whether we're bird watchers or not, about the decline in our bird population. It's really been horrible when you look at the statistics. What are some of the causes that you think are the reason behind that decline?
So there's multiple reasons. So a lot of it could be the cats that are, roaming around outside. They're a major predator to songbirds. And this could be, you know, like your feral cats or the cats that are considered pets but are let outdoors during the day. So they take out a lot of the birds. During migration especially, there's a lot of collision with buildings and the windows as the birds are trying to migrate through. And this can happen either at night or even in the daylight based on, like, the reflection of the sun. Giving the impression to the birds, like, they can't see the glass, but they just see, like, a reflection of trees, and they think, oh, it's safe to keep moving through there. And sometimes, you know, you're thinking, oh, well, I don't live in a city, so that must not be too much of a problem. But a lot of big bay windows can be an issue for that as well. So, you know, the cats, the windows, and then, you know, climate change definitely plays a role in it, too, because things are just off, you know, like, I don't know about your spring, but here in Connecticut, we were very much ahead this year. So things were popping up and, you know, the insects weren't even awake yet. So that's definitely playing a role as well.
Yeah, we were lucky enough to have a beautiful spring also. You know, you mentioned insects. Have you looked into too much? We've heard a lot of reports about the pesticides and insecticides that are being used and causing a drop in insects, which in turn causes a drop in birds population. Have you heard that also?
Yes. And actually, there's some data that correlates to the use of the neonics, that pesticide that, you know, the plants like absorb and it grows into their system. If birds have access to like those seeds that have been exposed to that, that can cause damage to them as well. So it's not just, you know, the insects that are being poisoned. And, you know, insects are important because, you know, that's the primary food for birds, especially when they're raising their young. So if they're giving them tainted insects, you know, it's not going to help the survival of the bird. And then on top of that is, you know, the seed that you might put a plant in your garden and think it's safe, but it could be treated. So you have to check on where your plants are being sourced from as well.
Do your homework. We've got a call from JJ in Wanakee. Go ahead, JJ.
Hi. Yeah. Well, so it's, I asked my question before you started talking about the topic, and now it's more relevant. First, I wanted to share my spark bird, which was a beautiful barn owl at my family farm in Kansas. Just gorgeous bird, probably like a mature female, like 3 foot, 4 foot wingspan, just gorgeous.
Yes.
Wonderful.
And then my question is about insect populations and if your garden tips go into boosting insect populations. You mentioned, you know, having treated things and that poisoning the insects or making the insects less likely to be around, and that hurts the birds. But then, you know, just how much of it is build a garden that supports insects and that also supports birds.
Great point, JJ. What do you think, Jen?
Yeah, I mean, having the insects as a critical part of your garden is important. I think, at least, you know, speaking from personal experience, I have a father who is very much like, I want the perfect landscape. And that involves not having things that are chewed on. But when I go outside into my garden, you know, seeing that the leaves are chewed on, that's a great sign for me because that means that there are insects in the garden. And then as a result, there's going to be more birds coming in to eat those insects. And that was actually one of the topics in the book. I created a medium space size project that focused on plants that would really bring in those birds that would be attracted to the insects, either the caterpillars or the small, you know, ants or beetles. And it attracts such a wide variety, and sometimes you're able to even attract birds that are migrating through that normally wouldn't be residents of your garden, such as, you know, the warblers that come through or the vireos. I always say that wrong, so sorry. And then some, you know, common ones like, you know, the wrens, you're definitely going to have them visit, and the robins. And yeah, it just opens up a whole door. So insects in the garden is definitely a good thing.
You have a really interesting kind of a quote from Doug Telmy about how many caterpillars it actually needed to raise one family of black-capped chickadees.
That's right.
And I had no clue.
Yeah, and it's a crazy amount. It's between 6,000 and 7,000. And if you have ever had the, you know, the pleasure of having a nesting family in your garden, you'll see how often they visit that nest to bring the insects in. So yeah, they're looking for those insects, not just on like the shrubs and, you know, in the grasses, but a lot of our trees. And Doug Tallamy is a very big proponent of keystone plants. And I think the one he's most vocal about are oak trees. And that's because they are such a host to a variety of insects. And, you know, if you can incorporate one of those in your garden, you're doing like just the number one, like you get a gold star to start off with, you know?
Well, I have two, so I am very impressive.
Oh, two gold stars.
Right. I mean, you need a complete ecosystem, right? Or ecosystem. It's not like you just can do one thing and that's going to do it.
Correct. Right. It's all connected. So it goes back to, you know, what you're learning in grade school, right? Where you have like the map of who eats who. Mm-hmm. That definitely is playing out in your garden every day. So if you have those little insects, someone's coming in to eat those insects, and that would be, you know, the birds. And then sometimes the birds are attracting other bigger birds to your yard, such as the hawks or maybe the owls too. So yeah, it's all connected. And if one source in the food chain gets compromised, it definitely feeds its way up, and it's compromising the whole line.
Yes. So what are some of the bird species that are really seriously threatened? I think we probably, you know, we see those songbirds most often. What are some of the ones that are not doing so great?
So I would say it's definitely some of the ones that travel down to South America for the winter. So those would be like your neotropical birds. They are a lot of the warblers. They will sometimes overwinter on coffee plantations. And that's another reason why if you can have access and support shade grown coffee that's bird friendly also, those plantations are making the area safe for the birds. So that way there's tree cover, there's no pesticides, and that's providing a safe haven for those birds to overwinter, as opposed to regular coffee plantations where, you know, there's not many trees at all. There is some chemicals used. So, it's definitely bigger than just your garden. And then those are the birds that are going to overwinter down south and then come back up during the spring migration and pass through our area on the way to their final nesting grounds.
We kind of touched on this a little bit, but what's the connection between native plants and the insects and birds?
Oh, so great point. So the native insects and the native plants have basically co-evolved together over several years. So there's this relationship where, you know, you plant this, let's say milkweed. That's the one that everyone really
right.
can get right, right? So if you have milkweed, that's the one that supports the monarch caterpillar. The monarch caterpillar can't eat, petunias or hydrangeas. They definitely need that milkweed to survive. So that relationship with the native plants, it's very in tune with the insects that are available in your region. So that way it supports that environment. And then if you have a healthy population of those insects, then that provides food for the birds. There's a lot of plants that are popular that are, you know, brought in from other countries. And that would be like, you know, our hydrangeas is like a perfect example. There's ones that, you could have cultivars like daylily, stuff like that. Like they're beautiful, but they're not supporting insects and
sure.
they're not making the food.
We're talking on Garden Talk today with writer, editor, and photographer Jen McGinnis. Her new book is Bird Friendly Gardening, Guidance and Projects for Supporting Birds in Your Landscape. Join us in with your questions by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hope you can stay with us today. Coming up at the top of the hour, we'll talk with an expert on ground covers, and she'll have advice on how to use them to replace turf in your garden. Right now, we're talking about how to get those birds to your garden and the importance of that. Jen, why don't you talk a little bit about the book itself and what people can find in it?
Sure. So Bird Friendly Gardening, I wrote it with the intention of, you know, maybe you're not an expert when it comes to birds, or maybe not even an expert when it comes to gardening, but you have an interest in making your property more inviting to the birds. Or perhaps, you know, you go out and you're a bird watcher, but you want to bring them in closer to your garden so you don't have to, you know, travel out to see them.
Sure.
So I kind of had that mindset in mind, and I wanted to create something that anyone could just like pick up the book and start to adapt it to their area. So I took into consideration the size of our gardens. So that would be like small areas, like you have an access to a balcony, maybe a postage stamp sized garden, or a medium sized traditional garden. Like when you think of like a front lawn and a back lawn, like converting that into an area that would be friendly to the birds. And then there's also a section that talks about larger property spaces. So if you're fortunate enough to have access to like a lot of land or a lot of trees on your land, you can, you know, incorporate certain varieties that would make things more hospitable to the owls and to the woodpeckers and just bring in more, more birds in general. So with that in mind, I started coming up with garden plans that would work for those spaces, but taking into consideration that You need a variety of plants, right? Because not everyone has the same growing conditions as you do in out west or Midwest or even in the Northeast. So I was looking for a lot of native plants that had crossover on those native ranges. So there could be like sneezeweed. That's a great native that actually is native to like the whole U.S. So no matter where you put it, it's good.
Right.
And then there would be other ones like columbine, which I believe is only pretty much, you know, native like in your area, my area, like parts of the Southwest, but maybe not so much like down in deep Florida, if I remember correctly. I was trying to incorporate all that. And then the nice part is that say you fall in love with a plant that's not native to your area, you can usually go to your independent garden center and say, hey, like I love this shrub that is flowering out in the Southwest. What do we have that's similar here that would flower during this time, get about the same height? And those independent garden centers can definitely be a great source to point you in the right direction.
That's a really good point. I like that. So what elements do we really need in our garden to create a good habitat?
Sure. So we definitely need to focus on the food, right? So we've talked a lot about the insects as being a primary source, but the food can also consist of plants that are providing seeds or fruit. So you're thinking those three areas when it comes to that. You'll want plants that provide cover to protect them from predators, and that could be, you know, hawks flying over or other birds, because sometimes you have like blue jays that will, you know, rob nests because they're jays, that's what they do. So you need some cover to protect your nest. And then tied into the nest is the nesting material. So you want to provide plants that will provide that, the long grasses to make your nest, or maybe the little twigs that the wrens use to make their nest. So when you have all three of those, it's kind of like the trifecta, right? Like one plant in general that is fantastic for providing all three, food, cover, and nesting material, is little bluestem, which is a grass.
Yeah.
And it grows pretty small. Like, it's not like the larger variety that gets fairly big, but, it's also got really nice ornamental value. It changes from blue to green to red in the fall. And then the seeds feed the birds. It provides the cover. If you're out in the Midwest, that grass would be great for like the ground nesting birds that would need it for cover as well. That's just an example of one plant that would fit all the criteria.
And what else do we need as far as like water? Is that important?
Oh, yeah. So water is, when it comes to, it has to be fresh. So if you're providing a bird bath, you'll definitely want to keep it clean, keep it with fresh water and not letting it like sit out and get murky and attract those mosquitoes. You know, you want to, like,
right.
If you don't want to drink from it, the birds aren't going to want to drink or bathe in it.
Yeah,
you know?
Good point.
And then that's definitely a major factor in the wintertime. If you can provide an unfrozen source of fresh water, either by like a heated bird bath or sometimes people put out those like heated dog dishes for water.
Oh, yeah.
That can definitely bring in a variety of birds, too, because a lot of the native local sources are frozen over. So that's definitely a great way to bring in the birds. And that's actually how I got my first set of eastern bluebirds to show up. They were passing by through the winter and found the heated bird bath.
They know a good thing when they see it, right?
Absolutely.
Well, in that vein, we had Jeff email to say that when he purchased bluebird houses, he was surprised to learn sparrows are considered invasive and are removed by many bird enthusiasts. Is this a generally supported practice?
So there are ways to discourage the house sparrows from nesting in the boxes. They can be pretty vicious when it comes to nesting sites, and that's a great point that he's bringing up. Personally, like when I try to prevent them from even getting into the house, so if I notice that like a male house sparrow is starting to show interest in nesting there, and that's pretty obvious because he'll sit on top of the house and he'll just talk all day long and sing, 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 sing. I'll plug up the hole so that way he can't get in there and he can't like add nesting material. And that could last for like a week or two. If he does happen to get in there and start building a nest, like you can open up the nest box, remove it. You might have to do that a couple of times just to discourage them, to get them to move along. The reason why they're so controversial is because they will invade birdhouses and like attack the bluebirds and the bluebird babies. And it doesn't win them any fans. So if you can set it up for success and just keep them moving. Like I also try to take down my feeders when it comes to nesting time, just so they're not congregating and hanging around, because you know, the closer they are to your house with the feeders, they're going to be like, hey, this is easy, like nesting, food, we got this.
Sure, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's really hard to do that, but I know a lot of people recommend you do that.
Yeah, I know. Obviously, I don't want to hurt like any bird, but keeping them moving is definitely ideal.
Yeah, for sure. So explain what a layered garden is and why it's perfect for birds.
Oh, yeah. So layered gardens are the different levels of plants in your garden. So you'll have like a low growing area, which could be ground covers. That's right here you're going to be talking about.
Right.
So that could include the lower plants, too, like your small perennials. The medium level is another a level that will provide for shrubs. And then you have that taller level, which will be the small trees and the large trees, maybe the very large shrubs. And the nice thing about that variety of gardening and the plants is not only does it play into great design, because, you know, you have that tiered effect, but it also provides nesting habitat for a variety of birds, because certain birds will, you know, nest in the shrub layer. Certain birds will stay up high in the trees. Like I mentioned, like the warblers, they're looking for the insects very high up there that live in on the tree leaves. And then you'll have other birds who will be nesting lower to the ground, and that would be like your oven bird. So each layer of plants just provides that habitat, and the more you can provide, the more you increase your odds to welcome in a variety of birds to your garden.
And that brings up a point, too, that we've heard from other experts, is that put your bird feeders where there is cover like that, right?
Right, yeah. So if you have your bird feeder like out in the middle of a lawn, you may not really attract too many birds, because there's no place that they can, fly too quickly if there was danger or if they felt threatened. Having like a bird feeder near a small tree or like a shrub line provides not only that cover, but also like a perch area. So that way when they're waiting for their turn to go to the feeder, they have someplace to like kind of watch and wait.
Mm-hmm. If you've got a call or a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or if you want, you can send us an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones. We have Vivian in Green Bay with a comment. Go ahead, Vivian.
I've been bird gardening on my tiny city lot for more than 20 years. And one thing I had never thought about until the birds showed me, I recently had to regrade some of the ground around my garage. So I dug down, a square, maybe 2 feet by 3 feet, where I laid a slab, a rock, and then 8 inches of light dirt on top. And nothing grew there very quickly because of the slab. And the birds have been using that as a dust bath.
Okay.
I had never considered providing a dust bath.
That's a really good point, Vivian. Jen?
Yeah, that's a great idea. And you know, the birds are using those dust baths to help clean their feathers. So yeah, I can see how that brought in a variety. That must be really, really nice to watch too.
Yeah, for sure. So do you think that we should create our bird-friendly habitat for the birds that are already there and hoping we can bring in more? Or should we think about the birds that maybe aren't there and figure out how to bring them in?
So I think it's a mixture of both. So you definitely want to appeal to the birds that are in your area, right? So, like, I'll go back to my cardinal. I know they like to eat the berries in the fall. So I plant spice bush and winterberry for them just to keep them happy. But I also really want to, you know, maybe get a visit from a cedar waxwing, right?
Right.
So I have a plant out front, one of those crab apple trees. So I've put that in. So just hoping if they're passing over, maybe they'll see it and say, hey, let's go have a little meal over there, you know? So I think it's a balance of both. You know, there's also, I think, research around how when they're migrating in the springtime, the chickadees and the titmouse can actually help bring the migrators to your garden because they're sharing where the food sources are. So they have, I think it was David Sibley who actually shared that fact. And, you know, the birds kind of like, hey, this guy lives in this area. Let's follow him and see where he's going to have his breakfast. So you might bring in somebody that way, too, if you're appealing to, like, those little chickadees.
Like when you're traveling, eat where the locals eat.
Exactly.
We got an email from Daryl with a comment, and he said that they live in the Northwoods near Antigo, where they have been feeding birds for over a decade. Daryl says that woodpeckers thrive in the area and eat an enormous amount of suet. Yet on two occasions, a big red-billed woodpecker flew overhead and dropped a giant water bug right in front of him. He said, those are the bugs with the big pinchers, and he's sure the woodpeckers were sharing their bounty with him.
That's awesome. It sounds like they're very generous.
Yes, for sure. As long as it doesn't land on your head, I guess that's
exactly.
Now, these days, birders have a lot of help with some technology. You've actually talked about a couple of those apps in your book. Why don't you tell us about those?
Sure. So one of, I feel like a really popular one right now is the Merlin app. And that's an app that you can turn on like a button, like a play button, and it'll listen to your surrounding bird song and help you identify who's singing and who's talking in your garden or immediate area. And I really like that app because it helps with identification. So you don't necessarily have to know, like, hey, that little gray bird, that's a tufted titmouse, because you could just, you know, point in that direction and it'll help you identify it. And then, you know, connecting that bird song to the screen will help you with the memory recall of, like, oh, that's a tufted titmouse. And you can tell all your friends, right?
Right.
And then there's other sources like Birdcast, which is based through a website, and they track the migration of the birds in the spring and in the fall. So if you are planning, like, hey, next Friday, I want to go bird watching, I wonder who's going to be in my area and who I should keep an eye out for, you could type in your county and state into Birdcast, and then it'll give you a report of, like, these are the birds flying over your area. So I like to do that because sometimes it's like, oh, I had no idea that we were falling into that migration period and I might actually see that bird. So it gives me a heads up of, like, who to look for. So that's another great site.
Also, the one that you had in there, too, which doesn't have anything to do with a D, but it can help with plant selection. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so the Audubon Society has a great native plant website where you enter your 5-digit zip code, and then they'll produce a whole list of native plants to your area, so you can really, really zero in on the plants that will do well in your zip code. So that's a great website, too. And in the book, there's a QR code to help you get there even faster.
Yes, you have a couple of those QR codes, which, thank you, because that's easier for sure. We did get an email from Christopher to say that a recent study estimated that almost 7 million birds are killed each year by communication towers, with 97% of those being songbirds. He said the primary death, a cause of these deaths, is not the electromagnetic radiation, but rather collisions with the towers, especially due to disoriented lights that attract birds during poor visibility conditions. Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard about the communication towers, but the disorientation with the bright lights at night, I've definitely heard that with city buildings. And that's, you know, another reason why migration is such a dangerous time of year for those birds. And that's a great thing to be aware of. Unfortunately, you know, there's not too much like the tip, like, you know, a homeowner can do, but you could, at least in cities or, you know, towns where they have that overhead lighting broadcast all night, you can talk, like, you know, petition and advocate that, you know, let's turn the lights off or change the type of lights to have them pointing down instead of pointing up to help prevent that disorientation and getting the birds tired because they're flying around. And then, you know, they're not migrating through and they get stuck in the area. So I can definitely see how that's related.
That's a really good point with the lights, because we don't often think about, you know, we think about dark skies, it's better, but that's another reason why it's better to have those lights pointing down. So good
Absolutely.
To add that. So thanks, Christopher. Glad you were able to send that to us. And let's talk a little bit about the different plants. So we have invasive plants, and then we have non-native plants. And what's the difference between the two?
Sure. So invasive is when they really are just
yes.
over
everywhere.
yes, that would be like the knotweed.
Japanese knotweed. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. That just, you know, a little tiny piece gets put, like, cut up and it's everywhere. So that would be one of the invasives. It also happens to be not native. But then you could also have a non-native plant that behaves itself, you know, so it's not going to be troublesome. And that would be, like, a lot of your ornamental perennials fall into that category. You know, irises, hydrangeas, they're not native, but they're not going to be, you know, actively taking out other plants in your garden.
Sure. And then what about the true native plants and cultivars?
Sure. So that is a little bit of a hot topic lately. So there's debate between if a cultivar of a native plant is still as valuable as a straight species. And like an example, that would be your pink coneflower. That's a native, you know, it's very basic looking. You can identify it easily. And then a cultivar of that coneflower would be one that's got like the frillier petals or has like a milkshake top to it, you know. So it's still a coneflower, but the argument is that it's not providing as much benefit to the native insects because, you know, maybe it's not providing as much nectar or it's not shaped correctly to help them feed. So it really kind of depends on the cultivar. Sometimes, you know, if it's dramatically different from the original, then yeah, maybe it's not so great. But in all, like if you're still planting natives and cultivars as opposed to the non-natives, you're still hosting food for somebody local, you know.
Sure.
It may not be as wide of a range as like that straight native, but it's still better than not including it. So I think it's really up to the gardener to decide, you know, why am I including this cultivar? Is it just because I like its good looks, or do I really want to enhance the food availability for the area?
And do you think to just combining all of those is kind of a good balance? So you've got your pretty one, but you've got your native, who might also be pretty, but having a combination.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, just that approach that you're incorporating some natives into your garden, you can still have your non-native plants. You know, if you love hydrangeas, you can still have hydrangeas, you know. It's just about opening up your garden to start offering more opportunities
sure.
for the birds and the insects for food sources.
Yeah, diversity is probably a key word for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's go to Mike in Madison. He has a comment for us. Go ahead, Mike.
Good afternoon. I got a birding behavioral question. My dog likes to go out and go from, she's got free reign of a couple neighbors' yards, and she goes from garden to garden looking for mice and chippies and other things. But I've noticed that I've got a triplets of falcons that have been hanging out for the past few years. And when the dog is out in the yard doing her little mouse hunt, if there's a falcon around, he will make a ton of noise and call in the other falcons. And I believe, I just noticed about a month ago, now that I've been paying attention to it, they calling the other falcons when she's out doing her garden patrol. And I think it's because they think she's going to force some mice or chippies or a meal out of the gardens. And I just wondered if you had, if you've ever noticed this or any of your colleagues have ever heard of this before, because it's really, now that I pay attention, it's blatantly obvious that they're calling in their two other buddies to come in for a hunt.
I love that.
Well, I would definitely agree with you. I think that's what they're up to. I don't have too much background when it comes to falcons, but I'm thinking about how intelligent the crows are and how they, like, do something similar where, you know, they're keeping an eye on, like, either the people who are bringing out the food and they call in their friends. So, oh, I totally think it's possible.
I love that. Thanks for sharing, Mike. Our guest today is Jen McGinnis. She is a writer, editor, and photographer who writes as Frau Zinni at frauzinni.com. She is a proponent of organic gardening methods and wildlife-friendly gardens. Her new book is Bird-Friendly Gardening, Guidance and Projects for Supporting Birds in Your Landscape. Join in with your questions. We have open lines, the number 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Coming up on Monday, we're going to check in with tech expert Beth D'Angelo. She'll have info about the recent computer outages and also look at what the latest court decisions mean for Google. Right now, we're talking about creating a bird-friendly garden. And before we went to the break, I talked about your website, Jen, Frau Zinni. And as Joel, our producer, mentioned, we should probably spell that out, right? That's yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So it's Frau, FRAUNZINNIE. And what it represents is a rough translation of Mrs. Zinnia in German.
Okay. Well, we got that straightened out. What kinds
Thank you for asking.
Sure. Let's go to the phones again. We've got Bridget and Seymour with a comment. Go ahead, Bridget.
Oh, hi. It's along the same lines as the falcons coming by the dog hunting for mice. But when we go out in the open spaces of our yard, we have the barn swallows coming over from the farm. And they are swooping and diving and doing all kinds of things. I'm almost afraid of getting hit by one. But they're going after the bugs I rustle up for them.
Sure. That makes sense, right?
Absolutely. I bet you they're following, like, seeing all those insects, probably mosquitoes, right? They're following you around, and they're like, hey, they're making it easy.
You know, part of the, in your book, you talk about safely photographing birds, which I thought was a really interesting point to put in there. And the photos in your book, the birds are gorgeous. Did you take those?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I took the majority of the birds, of the pictures of the birds, I should say, except for some that were, like, very far out west,
Sure.
Just because I didn't get to visit, like, California, you know.
Darn.
But, yeah, the majority were taking in the, you know, the northeast and southeast portion of the U.S. And, yeah, there is some responsibility that comes when you're taking those photos, right? Like, you don't want to disrupt the area that they're in or compromise the nest. Like, if you're going to photograph a nest, you really should be using a long lens so that way you stay far away from it and don't bring attention to, you know, the nest. Like, you don't want to be right on top of it with, like, your iPhone and take a picture, because then that could, you know, if you happen to have a predator who's watching and say, hey, I see, you know, there's a robin's nest there. So that's one way to keep them safe. And you definitely, you know, they're talking about not baiting birds. And this applies more if, like, the owl photos. You don't want to, like, you know, put out mice to bring in the owl, so you could just take a picture of them. And there's certain birds too that you really, like, if you were taking pictures, you shouldn't share the location of where they are. And that applies a lot also to the owls, because people just get so enthusiastic and they're like, I want to see the owl, and then before you know it, you have, like, a whole crowd, and that's disrupting the owl's, like, nesting area. So there's some ethic responsibility when it comes to taking your photos too.
Right. And that applies applies to pretty much anything in nature, though. Just be careful.
Absolutely. Yeah, not just the birds.
Exactly. Michael emailed to ask when, where, and how to install blueboard houses, like how far apart, what directions should they face, and anything else maybe pertaining to placing and attracting bluebirds to houses.
Oh, sure. So a great resource for birdhouses in general is the Audubon Birdhouse Book, and they provide the plans and, you know, everything you need to know about, like, the placement, the size, the height, when to put it in. So I would definitely recommend that book. That's also produced by Cool Springs Press, who is the publisher of my book. But I could tell you just, like, off the top of my head, like, usually you put out those houses in late winter. So for me in Connecticut, that's around early February. And that's like the time where the bluebirds start going around and scouting and looking for a place to live. So you'll want to like check with your local Audubon Society to find out if that's relevant to your area. And then when it comes to placement, like they usually like to be in an area that's like an open field. Sometimes those big lawns come in handy for this. So that way they have an area to like fly out and fly across. Like they don't really nest in like the woodsy areas like you would expect like a house wren to. So that's one thing to keep in mind too. Like I don't usually attract too many bluebirds to my garden just because I have so many plants. It's a little cluttered.
Sure.
So my neighbor across the street, they're more likely to get the bluebirds because they have less vegetation and more of an open field that they prefer.
Okay. And we also have a bluebird society in the state. I think a couple of different cities have them, and we've talked to some of the representatives before, too. So there's always that local reference.
Oh, perfect.
Also.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about, like, nest boxes. What do we really need to know before we add them to our garden?
Sure. So you'll definitely want to make sure that you have a nest box with the correct diameter hole to attract the bird that you're looking for. A lot of the like decorative birdhouses that you'll see like in home furnishing stores or, you know, like Marshalls,
yeah,
they're more decorative. They're not really meant for the birds because the holes will be so large that, you know, a squirrel can get in there, right? So you want to make sure that you're buying your birdhouse from a like a reputable store. You can, you know, visit like Wild Birds Unlimited. They have a variety. The Audubon stores do. And there's a bunch of other, I'm sure, like garden centers that offer the real birdhouses that you need. And when it comes to the diameters, you'll want to take in consideration, like if you want a smaller hole or fairly larger, they all like range between that one, I want to say 1 inch to like 1.5 inches, like around that range. And then depending on the size would attract, you know, either wrens or chickadees or bluebirds. Those are like the primary birds that will use those houses. You won't be seeing like cardinals going into a birdhouse or mourning doves going into a birdhouse.
And what can we do to make sure that where we place them is a good place and that they're protected, you know, from pests and predators and things?
Sure. So you'll definitely want to make sure you have one of those guards on the pole if you're mounting it to a pole. And that's similar to how you would protect like bird feeders, right? You don't want like snakes to be able to crawl, line their way up or, you know, the squirrels to get up there. So you'll want to have that predator protection. If you are mounting it to like a fence post or a tree, that's something else you got to take in consideration. Like how easily is it for other predators to access. So you may not, you know, you might take a look at your area and say like, oh, this really isn't a good spot because this tree, you know, we have squirrels running up and down it all
sure.
day. Let's not encourage them to check it out.
I would think usually the birds would know that too, but not always, right?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes those birdhouses, they just look, you know, they're so desirable.
And then we have got a caller from Green Bay. Hi, Lee. Go ahead.
Yeah. I just wanted to make a comment on how foolish these people are in this, especially in the cities that have these lawn care services, spray all the toxic chemicals, especially for the robins. You know, that's got to be doing something to our robin population.
Jen?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, spraying your property for like the mosquitoes or the ticks or any insect, you know, you're taking out everybody. You're not just taking out that one insect. And you bring up a great point about the robins, because they primarily find their food sources in those big lawns. And yeah, the more you spray it, the more you're tainting that food source, and they're feeding it to their babies. And yeah, it's just a vicious cycle. So the more you can do to advocate and explain to people, like, you don't need to spray your yards, you know, you can make sure you're getting rid of that standing water that brings in like a lot of mosquitoes. Make sure you're getting rid of that. I think Doug Tallamy has like a bucket of doom, if I remember correctly, where it's like a trap where you can, you know, use it to attract mosquitoes, but there's the BT baits in there, so that way they never actually make babies. So, yeah, there's a lot of different options besides just having a truck pull up to your house and spray.
And it's hard to remember that mosquitoes are food for other insects and for birds, too. So use a fan. Right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's a great point, too. And, you know, there's I've been trying out these little stickers that you put on your clothes that,
yeah,
like, are supposed to repel the mosquitoes based on the scent. And, yeah, I mean, I'm game for it.
There's other ways.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, we had talked about window strikes earlier, and they really do kill so many birds. Have you found some good ways to, you know, to stop that?
Yeah, so I've had luck with using the tape. It looks like bubble tape, and you can, you know, put it on your big windows and space it out. I believe it's like, I want to say every 8 inches, but don't quote me on that. But what you do is you make a pattern on your window, so that way it breaks up the reflection of the glass, so the birds are able to see it. They won't just see like a nice, beautiful shrub or a tree,
sure,
reflected back at them. Other items that could work include like painting your glass. Like if you are an artist and you want to go all out and, you know, put some tempera paint on your glass and make a design, that definitely will help. A lot of people use those hawk-shaped decals. You know, it's better than nothing. They have the UV reflected light on there, but usually you need a lot of them for it to work. Like just putting one in the middle of your window is not going to do the trick.
Right.
So that's just something to keep in mind. If you do go in that direction, you're going to need a good amount.
And just quickly in the last few minutes here, tell us a little bit about some of the birders, gardeners that you spotlight in the book, because we didn't get a chance to talk about them.
Oh, yeah. So that was another great feature that I was really happy to bring to the book, was showing how other gardeners are making their landscapes more bird-friendly. So one woman is Laura Jackson. She's out of Pennsylvania, and she has everything from, like, the grosbeaks coming in to the wood ducks. So she was lovely to talk to. And then another individual is Morgan Amos, and she lives out west, and she's in, like, a mountainside habitat. And she has a Instagram account where she's like Coffee and Chlorophyll, I believe her name is. And she is always sharing like beautiful photos of the birds that are coming through her yard. And it's just so fun to watch because, you know, we all have that passion in common. Like we love the birds. We want to attract them to the garden. And, you know, when you see other individuals and what they're doing to modify their landscape, it can spur an idea for you. And you're like, oh, I never even thought that I could, you know, take that empty area next to my driveway and make it a wildflower field and bring in the finches, you know? So yeah, the more gardens you can see, the better you are. And, you know, I've highlighted some individuals in the book who do a great job of that.
It's really interesting because some of them, they're creating things in unusual places too.
That's right. One gardener, I believe it was Susie, she created like a city garden where she worked with her Audubon Society to create a spot for, you know, the city dwellers to come and gather, and had a beautiful big wall mural. So it was like a nice community gathering spot. So, yeah, there's a lot of cool options.
And even if you don't really have a garden space, you can do things, you know, like in a patio or a balcony, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So even if you're, you know, up and you just have that window box, you can plant in some small plants that could even bring in the hummingbirds, right? So you'll have these small perennials that are like columbine that stay pretty compact, and, you know, it'll bring in the birds as they're flying through.
Well, wonderful, Jen. Thank you so much for sharing this book with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on to talk about birds. It's my favorite topic.
Excellent. Our guest today is Jen McGinnis. She is a writer, editor, and photographer who writes as Frau Zinni at frauzinni.com. We were talking about her new book. It's called Bird Friendly Gardening, Guidance and Projects for Supporting Birds in Your Landscape. Well, coming up at after the news, we're going to talk about ground cover. So stay with us. Well, for those who have it, keeping up with a lawn of turf grass, know that it can be a lot of work, and many people are looking for alternatives. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, and turf options is our topic today. Our guest is author, editor, and publisher Kathy Gents. Her latest book is called Ground Cover Revolution, How to Use Sustainable Low-Maintenance, Low-Water Ground Covers to Replace Your Turf. What would you like to know about using ground covers? Do you have a favorite? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Kathy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jill.
So tell us some of the reasons, besides having to cut the grass all the time, why we should consider replacing turf grass in our lawns.
Sure, Jill. So there are several reasons for environmental concerns. We want to use less gas inputs. It could benefit wildlife depending on what ground cover you choose. We could use less water if you have a intensely watered lawn, especially during drought periods. You might pick a drought-tolerant native. And then there are all those personal reasons, right, Jill? So maybe we're slowing down, or maybe we want to downsize. We want to have less maintenance and just an easier landscape to care for. And maybe we just want something more beautiful than a turf grass lawn.
Right, because as much as some people love it, it really isn't that pretty, is it? Yards,
yeah,
and yards of grass. It's. What is your definition of ground cover? Because that can bring in a lot of different plants.
Good question, Jill, because all I read about ground covers, I see many different interpretations.
Right.
Most people think of it as a low-growing plant hugging the ground, but I put it a little bit further than that. So some of my ground covers that I talk about in the book are a little bit taller, because my definition is if anything that can fill in thickly enough to suppress weeds. So that's what I consider to be covering the ground. So it could even be a small shrub or even a taller shrub, as long as it's thick enough that it's suppressing the weed growth underneath.
Oh, that's a great definition. Tell us about your journey to becoming a ground cover lover. I thought that was a really interesting story.
Yeah, so I moved from a condo to a small house, and I had left the condo only because the condo association kind of slapped my hand said, you're gardening in the common area now. That's no longer yours. And that's what I decided. I need some more space, maybe not a bigger house or anything, but I need some more space to garden, because obviously caught that gardening bug like crazy. And so the home I purchased is on a very busy urban corner right outside of Washington, D.C., and it's kind of a pie shape or a pizza slice wedge. And on one side, big, tall oak trees, thick roots, very dry shade, and that was solid English ivy underneath them. And then the point where it came out, the pizza slice on the other side of the house, all turf grass lawn up to the foundation. And so I spent my first year in the house just ripping out all that lawn and replacing it with anything I could find that said fast spreading, aggressive, if I went to a plant swap and then they said, this is taking over my yard, I was like, sold. Give me that plant.
Did you regret that decision?
Oh, yeah. There are several regrets that years later, it's kind of the subtraction game, right?
But right.
It helped me do a lot of experimentation. So I was able to try a bunch of different ground covers and see where they were most successful and where they weren't. And then also kind of, I call them fight against each other. So I would clear out a section of English ivy and then plop a ground cover in the middle of the cleared part. And then I would say, go for it. Like, try to hold off the English ivy is all I asked. Like, I was like, just hold your own against it would be my best hope. But I actually found one ground cover that not only held its own, but overcame the English ivy and actually swallowed sections of it. So I was like, wow, you are a powerhouse.
Okay, you have to share that with us.
Definitely. So that was the Epimedium. So also known as, some people will call it bishop's hat or fairy wing, which, you know, a lot of people would consider that a kind of little, you know, fancy little plant that looks like it's a little bit dainty on the dainty side, but it actually has a really fibrous, thick root system, and that's how it was able to do that. So there are, I should be super clear here, there are collector epimediums that can be, you know, hundreds of dollars, tiny little specimens for your rock garden. But in the ground cover case that I'm talking about that very common rubrum or sulfurium epimediums, the very common pink or yellow that you can get at most any garden center. They make terrific ground covers.
And just beware that it will take over a lot of space if left, right? Okay.
Yep. So it'll, like, one piece will mound to like 3 to 5 feet eventually section, and then you might knit it with another ground cover. But it's great for holding in a slope, for erosion control, tolerates dry shade and amongst tree roots very well. So aside from being a good one against English ivy, it has other great attributes.
And it's a nice looking plant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Especially the fall color. I'm always surprised that people, we talk about the little fairy flowers that form in the spring, and it's got a nice foliage look, but it turns to kind of like a burgundy blush in the fall. I think it's one of the prettiest for fall color.
Mm-hmm. And we're always looking for that for sure. And we talked about some of the benefits of ground cover, but what are some of the other ones? I mean, I know living mulch is a great one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you have a lot of shrubs or tree plantings, it's great to surround them with a ground cover for several reasons. One is to protect the root zone and also to protect the trunk itself, especially on a small tree, because we all know those overzealous mowers, right?
And, yes.
And weed whackers, and we're all guilty ourselves. We've done the same thing. We're just trying to hurry up and finish that mow, and then we're like, zoop, oh, we just sliced into the bark of that tree or that shrub, or we cut off a branch or something. So a nice skirt of ground cover around it is a great benefit. It also acts as an indicator plant. So I was reading one study that showed that trees, especially street trees in the city with ground cover around them, did better than trees without, that just had maybe brick or something else or iron gate around them, because once the ground cover starts to wilt, you water it because that's what you're looking at. Versus the tree, you might not be looking up and realizing this needs extra water.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. I've not thought about it that way, but yeah, for sure. And I would imagine it does provide a little shade for those roots also when it gets really hot out.
Mm-hmm. And I think it also protects it from compaction, the roots. So we're less apt to walk in there because, you know, it's something flowering or pretty is growing in there. I think another benefit of it, I was just reading a new study that talked about safe landings. And I was like, safe or soft landings is another term for it. And I was like, who's that for? So that's basically for your baby birds, maybe your little cocoon insects that are emerging up in the tree, and then they fall out and boop, you know, pop into a ground cover, and then they're able to recover underneath versus, you know, compacted ground or concrete or something else underneath the tree.
Well, as one who trips over everything, I think I would appreciate a soft landing too.
Definitely.
So let's talk about the book itself. It's great. Mm-hmm. Great resource for anybody who wants to add ground cover to their garden. I really like that detailed chart in the book that helps you select it, which is going to do well for you. So tell us about that chart and what people will find in it.
Yeah, so that's a lot of people's favorite parts. So it's a chart that rates the attributes of the ground cover. So you can go across the top and look for what benefits or attributes you're looking for, and then select your ground cover from that. So it might be something that's deer resistant, but is drought tolerant, and also has flowers for pollinators. So you might be looking for those. And so we have, it's kind of a color, green, yellow, red chart scale. So you would look for ones that have the most amount of green in that. So you can look for ones that are more shade or sun, look for ones that are faster spreading or slower spreading. And then I added a few categories that I hadn't seen in other ground cover studies or research that I read. And one of them was fire safe. So I was more and more were concerned about, you know, fires, especially
yes.
in the West, but, you know, more and more coming in the Midwest and the East. So obviously you want a ground cover that doesn't bring the fire right up to your house. That would be, you know, not
that
good.
That would be good. No, not at all.
That are better for that, and some that are worse. And of course, just chip mulch or bark mulch would be kind of on the worst end of the scale.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. And this is 6 pages long, so we're not talking about a tiny little, you know, a few. She's got a lot of them covered here. One of the categories that might be useful for a lot of people who listen to this program is that you do put in if they're deer resistant, because we do get a lot of calls about that.
Yeah, I can imagine. We have so much deer pressure where I am on the East Coast. It is, you know, something that a lot of gardeners have had to throw in the towel and give up gardening almost for that. So I'm super aware of any of the ones that are deer resistant. We're never going to say deer proof, right? Because there's always some exception or some little fawn that likes to take a chomp out of it, even if it's poisonous or even if it's, you know, has toxins in it, they still will take a chomp to taste and learn it's bitter.
Yes.
Of course, I always say, you know, even if they don't eat your hostas, that might be where they make their bed. So they're kind of crushing it and pushing it to the ground there too. Yeah.
Yes. We got an email from Eve in Middleton, and she said that they have a county prairie in front of their house, and their front yard is a narrow strip with low-growth sumac. Now, the prairie is encroaching, which is kind of an unusual situation, but she's wondering if there is a ground cover or native grass that could form a dividing line between the prairie and her yard.
You might look into some of the sedges. That might be a good transition between them. So you could have some more of the sun-tolerant sedges could be that edge right there. And that could be a native sedge, of course, or you could get one of the hybrids. I'm also thinking about even Rudbeckia, which I recommend as a nice ground cover because it has that base foliage or basal foliage.
True.
Not like the herb, not basil with IL,
no.
But basil. AL foliage that stays and hugs the ground. Of course, that's going to need a little check and reseeding, you know, because, or at least cutting off the seed heads if you don't want it to reseed elsewhere.
Because that will take over too. So it's kind of a prairie plant. The sedges would be a great idea. It would be really pretty. So good luck with that, Eve. If you've got a question or a comment for us on ground covers, please give us a call. Our guest today is Kathy Gents. She's the author, editor, and publisher of Washington Gardener Magazine and the Green Media columnist for Mid-Atlantic Grower newspaper. And her latest book is called Ground Cover Revolutions. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Next week on Garden Talk, Mark Dwyer is back to talk about designing for shady areas in your landscape. And then we'll also talk about an effort to grow more shade in Madison. Hope you can join us on then. But right now, we're talking about ground cover. So many options. And I wanted to ask real quick here, Kathy, before we go to the phone, do we have to be concerned about the different kinds of ground covers we can, you know, put together?
As far as some of them can be a little bit more aggressive than others.
Mm-hmm.
So one can take over the other, as experiments with English ivy showed. So there's a few that are just bad actors in general.
Okay.
And that would be, include English ivy and some of the vincas. Usually will want to take over the world. So you'll need to put in some barrier system or have it pinned in, you know, could be between a sidewalk and a brick wall, then those might be able to control those.
What are your favorite ways of containing ground covers? Do you use edging or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll use a metal edging strip will be one way, and you can just get out the electric weed whacker, you know, string trimmer. Also, to maintain a line, like once or twice a season, if you're like, this is the line and you shall not pass. So you can usually use it as an edger, or you can get the old-fashioned edging tools out as well, like the half-moon edger, if you can just make quick work that way, too.
Yeah, there's something satisfying about using that half-moon edger. I'm not sure what it is, but I like mine. Let's go to the phones. Rebecca in Arpin, what can we help you with?
Hello. We have a very steep and pretty deep ditch in front of our house, and it's just brutal to mow. So we're looking for something as a ground cover, but part of the issue is, of course, it's very dry on top, kind of a sandy soil, but as you go down, it can be quite wet. And so we're looking for something that maybe would be happy in either place that we can plant there.
Hmm. Is it very sunny on the slope?
It is a northern, no, not particularly. It's a northern exposure, although it does get east-west sun all day because it fronts a busy street.
Yeah, so I might recommend, like, a creeping evergreen, like a juniper at the top that will come down, and then another ground cover at the bottom that kind of goes up, if you know what I mean, to do plugs going up the edge. So you can use some of our native junipers. You could also do a matrix of some of the sedums that are more shade-tolerant because it is north-facing side. So sedum ternatum is an eastern native one you can think about, but I would do like several plugs of different sedums as a trial this maybe end of summer, early fall, and see how well they do and overwinter for you, and then expand on those next spring.
That's a great idea, Kathy. I love sedums in that area. It makes a whole lot of sense, and there's so many of them.
And there's almost, you know, hundreds and hundreds of sedums. So in the book, I talk about some of the native ones for the U.S., but also some of those gorgeous hybrid introductions like Angelonia or Angelina. It has like 10 different nicknames or common names to it. But it is a beautiful one because it kind of turns those sunset shades in the wintertime, and it's a fast spreader. So that's usually one that works really well.
Okay, great. Thank you, Rebecca, for that question. Let's go to Tom in Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I've got an area, it's probably, I'd say 30 feet by about 20 feet. That's very shady. Nothing grows there. I was hoping the native violets would take it over, but they haven't. They pop up here and there, but that's about it. What can I put in there to cover it so I don't have mud every time it rains?
So there are a couple plants that I recommend that are on the some invasive species list because they are so, we'll just call them successful in situations. where when somebody tells me nothing else grows there, and I'm like, that's where you put your lily of the valley. So the lily of the valley has those underground stolons and spreads, and it will stay contained because it's in that those super poor conditions, and it'll be a slower spreader in that situation. But if you were to put it, say, in your beautiful perennial border, then in 2 years you would have nothing but lily of the valley, right? But in this situation, it actually acts as a really good remedy plant. And then in a few years, you might be able to put something else better there.
Yeah, lily of the valley works really well in those situations. And it smells good and it's pretty. So good luck, Tom. Appreciate your call. So what kind of maintenance are we looking at when we put in some ground covers?
So usually the maintenance is all up front, and that's clearing the area, putting the plugs in or starting it by seed, and then keeping it weeded for the first couple of years while the ground cover establishes. And then once it fills in enough, then your maintenance goes way down. So depending on what ground cover you choose, it might need a once-a-year whack back to look good so that the epimediums I talked about before and the sedges, I might give them a shearing back in late winter, early spring, just for looks. It's not that they really need it, but, you know, it's nice to have new fresh foliage emerging at that point.
Sure. And we've got Russ in Belleville on the line. Go ahead, Russ.
Hey, Jill. I just want to suggest a couple of natives. I'm always trying to promote natives as ground covers. I've had great success with wild strawberry. It's good for the insects. Plus, if you can beat the robins to it, those small fruits are very sweet. Ooh. The other one is an annual plant, partridge pea, but it tends to reseed pretty heavily if you're in your right location, and the bumblebees absolutely just love it.
Okay.
Oh, I was just going to say, Jill, that I talk about strawberries as a yes. wonderful ground cover in the book because, again, just like he said, there's native ones, there's ones from Europe, there's ones from Asia, but, again, you get to eat some strawberries. And you have a beautiful ground cover. And the partridge pea, I've used it as a cover crop in my edible garden, but I've never used it as a actual ground cover in the ornamental garden.
Mm-hmm. And that's partridge pea, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Russ. We really appreciate you sharing those with us. Yeah, when I was flipping through and I saw the strawberries, I'm like, what a great idea. Because wild strawberries are amazing. They taste so good.
Mm-hmm. And then the runners are so easy to pluck up if they go in a direction you don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, your maintenance is just trimming them. And, you know, if you're feeding a lot of birds and maybe only getting a few strawberries yourself, that's, you know.
Oh, well. Yes. you had mentioned in the book establishing a tapestry lawn, and I've wanted to do that for so long but have never gotten to it. For those who are not familiar with the term, do you want to tell us what that's all about?
Sure. So that's knitting together a bunch of different ground covers that might have similar attributes. So it could be the sedums that we talked about before. It could be several different sedums in one area. So it could be like you cut out an oval lawn between your growing beds and make that almost look like a tapestry or oriental carpet look to it. It could just be random. You can intersperse it with ephemeral spring natives that pop up and then die back or a small bulbs like crocus or snowdrops. You can also do it with moss, which is one of my favorite ways to do a tapestry lawn, is if you have a kind of shady, damp section of your landscape to knit different types of mosses together over the years, and it's just so gorgeous looking.
It is, and that's another point to your book. The photographs are beautiful, and they really do show a lot of examples of what you can create.
Yeah, I tried to take a lot of photos myself and then source ones that I thought were inspirational, but also realistic. I wanted to look like, yes, this is what a yard will actually look like, not a fantasy, not AI, right?
Right.
Lock up. And also to be able to for people to use that so readers can take the book to their local HOA or whatever civic board or government and say, well, this is what I have in mind. I'm not trying to, like,
you know, buck the system and not have a green grass lawn or something pretty, but this is what it'll eventually look like. It also helps if there's somebody else in your household, say, who's not on board with getting their full turf grass lawn. Maybe sure. we just reduce the section and then it looks like this.
Yeah. No, that's a really great idea. I like that for sure. So one of the big problems whenever we decide that we're going to replace some of our turf with plants is getting rid of the grass. What are some of your favorite ways of doing that?
Well, I'm not a big fan of chemicals, mm-hmm. which you fruit. But what I describe in my book are a couple different ways to do it. The most backbreaking way, of course, is just getting a straight-edge shovel and getting in there and doing a section a little at a time. Don't be crazy.
You want to
save your back. But you can also rent sod-busting type machines or like a sod roller that kind of rolls it up like a carpet. That might be for a larger project. I also love to use the lasagna or layer method. So a lot of people do that for establishing a new bed in their garden, but you can also do it for sections of ground cover. And that's basically how I did my quarter acre, was just getting newspaper, lay it on pretty thickly, make sure there's no openings between the layers, because that's exactly where the weeds will pop up, is that one little tiny bit of crack of sunlight. And then wet it down or have somebody nearby with a hose because you don't want the newspapers to fly away while you're working. And then cover it with whatever organic compost material you have on hand. So that could be 5 inches or so of composted leaves. That could be straw. That could be whatever you have. And then basically you're cooking the whole thing. And you're, before the hand, you would have weed whacked down to the ground, whatever grass or weeds were there, and just let those lay there, because that's great organic material, too, to compost underneath. And usually in 3 to 6 months, you can plant directly in there and just have, you'll peel back the layers, and you won't even see the newspaper. It's just wood pulp, and so it composts really quickly.
That seems like the easiest way to do it. Now, we definitely want to avoid, like, landscape fabric and plastic, right?
Yeah, so I would say landscape fabric and plastic. If you have a pathway and you want to do gravel on top and maybe seed some things in the gravel, maybe landscape fabric. But, again, you're just going to have to keep on top of weeding that area. And then with the plastic, if you're really at your wit's end and you want to solarize an area, I would use a clear plastic shower curtain, you know, in the hottest part of summer, and you can kind of solarize, but you are killing everything down to probably an inch or so of the soil. So you are killing that first layer of microorganisms as well when you solarize. But I only recommend that if somebody has like a super tough weed patch, maybe multiflora rose and everything else that they've just, you know, not been able to get out of there.
And as far as when it comes to the plants themselves, do you prefer like seeds or plugs? I think you mentioned that a couple of times, or full established plants?
It's a lot easier to start with plugs. And it depends on the ground cover, because some can be like clover, easily started from seed. And I wouldn't say buy plugs of clover. That would be silly. It may be expensive. I mean, we priced that
probably.
Out.
Probably.
But, yeah. But I would say the smallest you can get, if you can't get a plug tray, then get the smallest size available, because you want it to establish good roots first and then spread out. So it's just like everything in gardening, which is your first year sleep, second year creep, third year leaf. It's going to take a couple years for that root system to establish. And if you start with, say, a gallon or larger, it takes a little bit longer, and they tend to stay where they are. Mm-hmm. They tend not as much. Also, a lot harder to plant several gallon plants amongst, say, tree roots or in compacted soil than it is to get like a dibble or a bulb planter and kind of work back and forth a little bit to get those little sedums or sedge plugs or prairie plug, plant plugs, or whatever you're working with.
And what do you suggest you do to cover the ground when it's exposed before those plants do spread out?
Yeah, that's super important because you don't want to leave any bare soil. So you could use any organic ground cover. So it could be shredded hardwood, could be your composted leaves. So anything that you can get to fill in, and you want to make sure you're not, you know, covering totally the ground cover, so you're not drowning it in whatever you're surrounding it with, mm-hmm. and let it spread a little bit.
And what about using things like preen that are supposed to stop, like, weeds from germinating?
Yeah, I've experimented with preen and similar products, and I just don't find them to work well for ground cover installations. First, you're going to grab, if you're doing it with seeds, you don't want to use a preen or similar emerging, going to bind onto those seeds as well as the weed seeds. I use those mainly in pathways or like between vegetable garden rows if I was going to use those.
Okay.
But other ways for weed suppressant could be some type of annual ground cover. So like your caller mentioned, the partridge pea, so you could have an annual ground cover or annual wildflowers or annual zinnia or whatever while you're waiting for your perennial or your shrub ground cover to establish.
Now then in the fall, do you pull those out or do you let them just lay on the ground?
I usually just let it all. I'm pretty laissez-faire gardener. I let it die back, and I figure that's the same thing as compost. It's just once living material, and unless you're trying to stop it from reseeding in that area, then you might deadhead it or pull it at that point.
Mm-hmm. And what about cold weather? Now, in our area specifically, we've got some very cold weather a lot of the time. What do you have sort of suggestions for plants that can tolerate the cold really well?
Yeah, so in the book and in the charts and the profiles, I put the actual temperature ranges because the book is published internationally. So it's in France and South Africa and Japan, and they wouldn't know what a USDA zone they were in. So I put the actual temperature ranges, so you'll find some of those for them. And I like some of the ornamental grasses that, you know, will have the foliage up, so that could be some of the blue grasses, and I'm just blanking on the Latin name that I love the most, Schizophragum. Okay, I'm saying it wrong, but I'll get you the Latin in a minute.
All right, no problem.
Schizo, but not schizo, but yes.
Okay. What about with salt? You know, we're using it too much probably, but there it is. It's against sidewalks and roads. Mm-hmm. We have some tolerant plants for that?
Yep. So we definitely list the salt-tolerant ones because same thing here. You know, they like to liberally use. I feel like at the end of the winter, they just try to use up their entire salt storage.
Yes.
On that last one. So those are also the ones that are great for coastal use. So along in sandy soils or lakes, those would be great ones for that. So definitely check the chart. But I find a lot of the sedums do well in those situations for salt tolerance. And again, a lot of the ornamental grasses are great for that.
Mm-hmm. And there are really a lot to choose from. So you do have a variety.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to Kathy Jentz. Her latest book is called Ground Cover Revolution. What questions do you have? Our lines are all open, so join in. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. Monday on The Larry Mueller Show, we'll have tech expert Beth D'Angelo back to talk about the recent computer outages that we had and to look at what the latest court decisions mean to Google. And of course, we'll take your tech questions. So I hope you can join us. That's going to be starting at 11. And then at 12:30, we're going to be talking about the upcoming PBS Wisconsin Quilt Show, which is always fun every year. So we'll find out a little bit more about that. But right now, we're talking about ground cover. So if you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. So Kathy, as far as, you know, we talked about having to water, especially that first year. What's your most favorite way of watering your new plants?
So I'm mainly a hand waterer because I like to make sure, because mm-hmm. I feel like any type of system we use, it's always going to miss a spot. and then obviously I have a rain barrel and rain gauge. You can do a drip irrigation or drip tape system for the first couple of years to get it established. But most ground covers should not need supplemental watering after that. If they do, then you have them in the wrong place. So I would say pick a drought-tolerant one if it's a dry place, or pick a moisture-loving one if it's a wet spot.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because, again, we're trying to avoid doing a lot more work than we have to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, I was looking at your bio, and you edit the quarterly Water Garden Journal, talking about water. Is putting a water feature and ground cover together a good combo?
Yeah, you can definitely surround it by some fun ground covers that can kind of weep over the edges. I love the look of that creeping or moss phlox kind of over a waterfall. Also, creeping Jenny, Lysimachia, the golden one, that not only can you put it around the edge, but it will go across the water.
So oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so basically it doesn't even need soil. It will grow in pebbles. It will grow across concrete. But what I get planted, sometimes people will do a container in the middle of their water garden or water feature. So it might have your papyrus and cattail or miniature cattail, and you might tuck a little bit of the golden creeping Jenny, and then it will just pop out and kind of creep across the water too.
And it's beautiful. Like you said, the golden one, I've got some in my garden, and it likes to creep everywhere. It's going over the sidewalk. So be careful about where you put it. We've got another Russ. This one's in New Glarus. Go ahead, Russ.
Hey, hello.
Yeah, what can we help you with?
Yeah, well, a couple of my questions were already answered. We have the situation where it's a pretty steep bank going down to the road ditch. So we were concerned about the slope and the salt resistance, which you've already talked about. We also have a large walnut tree that's at the top of the slope, but it's right about in the middle of the span. And wondering about things that will coexist with walnuts, because we found out that not everything does.
No, it does not.
Yeah, I would think a lot of the ground covers that are shallow rooted would do well for that situation. And ajuga, or bugleweed, is one that I found actually does pretty good under black walnut especially. And because usually the root system is only an inch or so, and it's not going to interfere or be exposed to the walnut root system. It's just trying to eliminate any competitors, right, in its root zone.
Well, I can attest that I had a black walnut tree. I had ajuga growing like crazy under it. So, and it's a very pretty plant, too.
Yeah, and there are so many new introductions of ajuga coming onto the market now. You have the toffee and chocolate chip, the kind of really nice variegated ones, and then the solid darker ones. But now they're coming in these like kind of sunset fire colors. So you could do some really interesting things with different ajugas.
Oh, for sure. That would really lend towards that tapestry lawn that we were talking about, too. So, yeah, good choice. Good luck with that, Russ. I would definitely recommend it. You have a part in the book you're talking about, Solving Landscape Challenges. And I noticed that you have ground covers in, like, containers. That's an unusual way to do it, isn't it?
Yeah, so you can sink them in a container, or you can just grow them in a container. If you're in a super, super small space garden, that's a great way to have a decorative effect. And ground covers also are the natural for fairy gardens or miniatures or your miniature railway systems. I always love to visit them because they have the best ground covers.
Oh, yeah, and I would imagine that maybe ground or rock gardens would be a good place to find them, too.
Mm-hmm. Usually you'll have, like, the nicer specimen ones in rock gardens, like we were talking about, some of the collector epimediums. But also think about those gorgeous little miniature hostas. Could be in a little hypertufa garden as well.
Mm-hmm. And I was looking at, what about soil? Soil is a very important element, obviously, in our garden. Do we need to be concerned about amending our soil or fertilizing it? What's your thought on that?
Yeah, so most ground covers shouldn't need any fertilizing, especially after establishment. And I do rate them for clay tolerance or compact soil versus sandy soils. So again, it's the whole principle of right plant, right place. So you want to choose the one that goes best with the native soil that you have been dealt with, rather than having to amend it too much. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of, when you amend the planting hole with a great, rich, beautiful soil, that plant does not want to leave that planting hole. Like, years later, you'll come back and you'll find that hydrangea or whatever shrub you might have done that with will have circled roots and not even expand into the surrounding soil.
We just want to be so helpful to our plants, but that's mm-hmm. not always a good idea. We got an email from Deb in Galesville, and she said that a lot of Midwesterners hate Creeping Charlie, but Deb has had success using it around buildings. And after working at garden centers and seeing customers pay big money for ground covers, she said that Creeping Charlie is very cheap. It fills in wonderfully well. It grows in both sun and semi-shade. It's easy to control with a simple pull, and it has a nice fragrance. And as a big bonus, the bees and insects use it, especially in early spring. She says, mm-hmm. less hate and more respect for Creeping Charlie. She sounds like she's part of your revolution.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you also reframing some of them that are considered aggressive or weeds or getting that title, because they're just successful or super successful, we'll call them, Jill.
Yes.
So that people are like, taking same thing, the caller who referred to the wild violets and wanting them to spread in that area. They're one of my favorite ground covers, and they've just been so demonized by the lawn care industry. Yes. Because it's a broadleaf plant, and it's going to be killed with a broadleaf weed killers. So, but it is such a beautiful, wonderful plant for our wildlife, makes a gorgeous ground cover, and we have, you know, native versions of wild violets and other exotic versions you can introduce too.
And that's, excuse me, that's our state flower, actually, is the wild violet. Yeah. And they are wonderful in the spring. And I let mine grow in my garden beds because it is a nice filler. But then later on, when it starts crowding out my regular ones, I kind of shake my fist at it. But, you know, it's a love-hate relationship.
Yeah. And it's one of those ones that you can dig up and move it around a little bit.
Yes.
So if it doesn't pop up or recede, like, way over on, into your rose patch and you don't want it there, easy to take it out.
Yeah. It is. JJ in Wanakee called wanting advice for how to persuade people to convert their imported monoculture lawn grass to native and drought-resistant grasses.
Hmm. So, again, you could use the book as examples, but you can also talk to them about their inputs and how much they're spending, not just in money, but time. So I started a national holiday, which now is going international. That was the first one ever this year on May 20th, which is called Reduce Your Lawn Day. So it's about converting small sections of your lawn, just committing a little bit each year. So he could use that as some type of event in his community to gather people around. And I think the best way to sell people, so to speak, on lawn replacements with other lawn materials is to do a demonstration, to have it in a public area. So he could volunteer to have it in a park or somewhere else that is accessible to other people, and then invite them to come and see it.
Yeah, all great ideas. And I know, well, he's in Wanakee, so he's fairly close. There are some botanical gardens in our area that have great examples of that. So he should take a look at those and take some pictures. Maybe that would probably help, too. So.
Mm-hmm.
Kathy in Oconto emailed to ask for a ground cover suggestion for under a line of tall white cedars. Right now, lilies of the valley are doing well there, also some wild ginger. But what else can she introduce to this area that's it's very shady for most of the day?
Yeah, so I love the use of wild ginger. Such a wonderful ground cover. But also think about the hardy geraniums, so the spreading geraniums, not the zonal geranium that you would, you know, plant in your window box in the summertime, but these are the ones that have a huge root. So it's Geranium macrorhizum, and they have the same dainty little foliage or flowers. It has a spicy little scent to it. Very shade tolerant. I have them growing under evergreens, under junipers that are taller growing junipers, and under cedars, and even under magnolia. And if you've ever grown magnolia, which you'll know that that foliage will drown out everything. It's got such huge leaves that drop down. So if that can survive under magnolia, it could probably do a great job under there for her. And they're pretty drought tolerant once established, and they like dry shade.
And that's what you have under cedar trees and a lot of the, yeah, a lot of those. I have got some myself, and the Lily of the Valley and the Wild Ginger are doing well. And I also have some ferns in there, and of course, hostas that are doing pretty good. But you, I was surprised when you used ferns as a ground cover.
Yeah, the ferns can be, you know, a really thick layer understory in many of our woodlands. So I say, you know, take the tip of Mother Nature. She usually plants a wide swath of them. And usually it will be, you know, somewhat shady and damp area, but some ferns do like a little bit more sun. Some ferns can take a little bit less moisture, so you might look for those. I love the evergreen ferns, and in my area, Christmas fern is a native that does really well.
Oh, I don't think that they grow here, at least not survive. Mm-hmm. But you have to experiment, because we can create microclimates in our yards, can't we?
Mm-hmm. And you can create a berm or experiment with one or two. And I don't know, I was in Wisconsin last year touring gardens in Madison, and I saw some nice thick plantings of ferns in Asian-style gardens,
mm-hmm.
along with mosses. So I think you can adapt those pretty readily to a regular landscape.
Yeah, we have quite a few different varieties that are native. Just be careful, they do can be a bit invasive. So as always, just make sure you know what you're planting. What are some of your favorite like sources for ground cover nurseries?
So there's a lot of wholesale nurseries out there that will sell you like several plug trays if you were to get together with some neighbors or fellow garden club members and do a group purchase together. And you can always go to your local independent garden center and say, tell them you're trying to establish this as a ground cover. I just don't want a couple, you know, half gallon or gallon pots of this. Would they be able to order plug trays for me? And in the back of the book, I do have a list of some of those wholesale sources that you can go to. So Midwest Ground Covers is a great one for your region.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. Have you ever had much luck with buying a larger, maybe gallon pot and then dividing it and putting the different pieces of it around?
Jill, you are singing my story. That's the story of the cheapskate gardener. So, yeah, definitely. I have done that when you're like, oh, this one looks good. And yeah, I can make 10 more plants out of this. For sure. So the creeping moss or phlox, that's a good one to divide and do around. Sedum, classic case where you can take one plant and make several out of it. So I definitely, when you're looking at the garden center, look inside that pot and see how many actual separate little plants you have in there.
Okay. Yeah, especially this time of year when things are starting to be on sale, and a lot of times it might be larger pots like that. Any advice for people buying plants at this time of the year when it's still pretty hot?
Yeah, so you might put it in a shady spot to the side, keep it well watered until you want to actually do the planting in the fall time. But yeah, you're right. The now is a great bargain time to go to your independent garden centers and buy up the plants, because they're trying to get those racks emptied out and their new fall plantings in. So this would be a great opportunity to swoop in and get some really good bargains.
And so as we wrap up here, just off the top of your head, what are the main things people need to think about when selecting ground covers for their yard?
First, again, you're going to evaluate your situation, your soil type, and what you're looking for. Like, do you want something super low maintenance that establishes very quickly, or can you wait a few years? So once you know those things, you can start to narrow down your choices. And then, as you said, Jill, go to your local public gardens, and they will have lots of examples for you to be able to see. And, of course, the photos in my book might help as well. So you can pick them in your own landscape. You can go there, take photos. And I'm one who walks around with my phone in my pocket, which is also a camera.
Uh-huh.
And
so
wherever you go in your neighborhood, if you're walking a dog, whatever, taking pictures of what's successful in neighbors' lawns or gardens.
That's right.
That's running really well there. It'll probably do well for me.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And there are apps that will tell you what that plant is. So there you go. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you today, Kathy. And thank you for writing this book. I think it was definitely needed.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Kathy Jentz. Her latest book is called Ground Cover Revolution, How to Use Sustainable, Low-Maintenance, Low-Water Ground Covers to Replace Your Turf. I want to thank our whole crew for making this show and all the others. Our producers are Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm executive director. And, of course, our regular host is Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us.